Hi, this is Jim from Safety Wars. Before we start the program, I want to make sure everyone understands that we often talk about OSHA and EPA citations, along with some other regulatory actions from other agencies, legal cases, and criminal activity. Everyone is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Proposed fines are exactly that, and they are often litigated, reduced, or vacated. We use available public records, news accounts, and press releases. We cannot warranty or guarantee the details of any of the stories we share, since we are not directly involved with these stories, at least not most of the time. Enjoy the show.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
And from OSHA Region 3, this is Jim Polzel with Safety Wars. For Thursday, June 19th, 2025, it is Juneteenth. We'll be talking about that in a minute here. How's everybody doing? So, why are we talking about Juneteenth? I think it's important. I know that it's a holiday for some people, not me, is very controversial. Why do we talk about it? Why do we commemorate things like this? I don't know, maybe the liberation of millions of people, finally, after 300 or so years of slavery, and American slavery was very different, my understanding. There was a lot of slavery in a lot of other places. So, they fought a civil war, 600 and some thousand killed, and that, and a whole bunch of other stuff out there. So, you know, it's important to remember these days, commemorate these days. There are all different types of websites out there going way back to the beginning of the internet, from the History Channel, everything. Well, no, on this day, this happened. Remember the history on this day, remember, and everything else. And it's important that we remember all these things. The other thing is this. Reality is much more brutal than anything anyone could ever make up. That's what my mother taught me on dealing with what she went through during World War II, and my grandmother and everything. Reality is worse than anything you could ever imagine. This is some of the danger that we have here with AI and all this virtual stuff with these darn things and everything else. Right? Nothing's authentic anymore. And if you have, you're able to deliver authenticity, and you're able to deliver unfiltered commentary, conversations, representations. That's much more valuable than anything. So what does all this have to do with Juneteenth? Now, it's important for us to remember. Oh, and by the way, happy birthday to my Aunt Sophie out there, who's at the Immaculate Conception Convent in Lodi, New Jersey, a Felician nun. She's celebrating her birthday today. She's been a nun for 75 years, right? So, Juneteenth, celebrated on June 19th, is a U.S. federal holiday that commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. Some of the historical background. On June 19, 1865, Union General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, and announced General Order No. 3, declaring that all enslaved people were free in accordance with the Emancipation Proclamation issued by President Abraham Lincoln on January 1, 1863. This announcement came more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation and months after the Civil War ended, because Texas was one of the most remote slave states and had minimal Union military presence. So this was, right, remember, 1800s. You had telegraph, you had very limited communication in a lot of ways. The Confederacy was conquered, was invaded, and everything else, right? So with that, a lot of stuff going on here. Some of the significance: Juneteenth marks the effective end of slavery in the United States, even though the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery nationwide, was not ratified until December 6, 1865. It's long been celebrated in African-American communities as a second Independence Day. Recognition: Juneteenth was made an official federal holiday in the United States on June 17, 2021, when President Joe Biden signed it into law. It is now observed with events such as parades, educational programs, music, food festivals, and community gatherings. Now, my first experience with Juneteenth was when I met my wife, and we lived in White Plains when we got married, and we were dating. She lived in White Plains when we were dating, and then we got married. I moved into White Plains, and there's a Juneteenth parade. And it was similar to, if you've ever been to New Orleans, right? Or if you've ever been to the Mummers Day Parade in Mummers Parade, I believe that's January 1st every year, New Year's in Philadelphia. Very festive and everything else. So that's when I first heard of it. What I find amazing is that a lot of African Americans don't know about June 19th or Juneteenth, even today. With that, now they were right. The slaves were released from slavery, and everything became official. We just went all through that. But being able to claim independence, to exercise rights, very long road with that. Even today, we see the impact of slavery in the safety industry. African Americans have a disproportionate number of accidents, injuries, and illnesses associated with the workplace for a whole host of reasons. I taught in a community outreach center headed by a university in New Jersey that did outreach to inner city neighborhoods. Most of the people who were participated in there, if they were usually African American, Latino, or other people, poor whites, also, and that just made it out of prison, that were looking just to improve themselves and things of that nature. So we give them safety training. And for them, no, they understand civil rights and everything that we've been brought up with, that is very important in that community. However, the right to a safe and healthful workplace has never been explained to folks in this community. And that's how I approached it. Where you have a right to a safe and healthful workplace, free of recognized hazards. That's the general duty clause here, right? And under the OSHA regulations and the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970. And you need to assert those rights. Now, the government's there to help guarantee those rights. And those rights do not come from government or from the act or anything. They're enshrined in the act, right? And government is there to help protect your rights and everything. But that's coming from God. A right comes from God or from nature, if you will. Natural rights. So when I'm what's my point? Important to commemorate days like this. All the struggles that we still go through. Well, Jim, you're as right-wing as they come. I know. I call Rush Limbaugh liberal, right? I get it. But truth. Can we get some truth? Can we get some authenticity? Can we get some of that context that we always talk about with the human and organizational performance? Can we get some blame fixes nothing, right? So Lionel on WABC radio last night was talking about why are things the way that they are? Why do people do what they think? I mean, why do people do what they do? Why everything? And again, this sound is going to sound familiar, right? So we have human organizational performance, context drives behavior, people do things, right? And this is the context, because they're incentivized to do things. That's as simple as it gets. That's how what safety is. So when you see people get hurt, people, right, sometimes it's truly an accident. But there's often an incentive, I would say most of the time, some type of a societal incentive, a corporate cultural incentive, all different types of incentives why people do things the way that what they do. And now, why was listening to Lionel at 2 o'clock in the morning? Because we had smoke alarms going off in the hotel, right? Malfunction in the fire alarm system. But, you know, and I would have loved to call him, but I had to get some sleep here. But essentially, that's what it comes down to. So what are the incentives, you know, and for people to do what they do? We have incentives. Everyone has incentives. And what are we going to do? What should we do? We should be incentivizing what we want more of. Right? That's basically what it comes down to. And we as a society have to do that. The other thing is authentic connections, reaching out to people, exercising that safety leadership, understanding the other person, what their point of view is. The more, now you see, Black Lives Matter gets it right on a lot of stuff. I'm going to say that. On a huge amount of stuff. One of them is that the country does have racists in it. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind. I see it out there all the time. I see it in the workplaces with the way that people are treated. We see it in communities with the way things are. And by the way, there's incentives all over. Politicians who run these communities, if they keep on getting elected, guess what? And they do nothing and keep on getting elected, guess what? They're going to continue to do nothing and keep on getting elected. So there's a lot of areas of agreement that we have with all these groups trying to make positive change in this country, in this world. We have more in common than not. We got to learn to work together. Got to learn to build each other up and help each other. That is how we're going to win that all-important safety war that we always talk about here on the program. And with that, I am going to go into commercial break. So we will see you back in a minute.
Safety Wars is streaming now. SafetyFM.com.
Have you listened or watched the Safety War show? It does stream live on the radio and on the streamer emers that we have. So if you have not taken a listen to Jim Bozell and what the hell he's doing every evening with Safety Wars, I would strongly encourage you to take a view or take a listen, whichever option is available for you, and take a listen to what the hell he has going on. It's definitely, it will take some deep dives and some information that you might be interested in.
In the professional safety community, communication and planning are just a few keys to your program's success. The question many practitioners have is, where do I start? Dr. Jay Allen, the creator of the Safety FM platform and host of the Rated R Safety Show, has built a global foundation to help you along the way. Go to safetyfm.com and listen to some of the industry's best and most involved professionals, including Blaine Hoffman with the Safety Pro, Sam Goodman with the Hop Nerd, Sheldon Primus with the Safety Consultant, Jim Pozell with Safety Wars, Emily Elrod with Unapologetically Bold, and many others. As individuals, we can do great things, but as a team, we become amazing. Dial into safetyfm.com today and surround yourself with a powerful force of knowledge and support.
Oh.
OSHA recordables, catastrophic losses, environmental disasters. You want answers? So do I. This is Jim Polzel with Safety Wars.
That's my daddy!
And we are back.
You are listening to Safety Wars.
Tomorrow's safety today.
All right. So that's basically it on what, you know, you could contact me, Jim, at safetywords.com. Tell me what you think. You know, we all got to get along. We all got to get together. And we're trying here. We're trying to improve here with us. And understanding, patience, loving your fellow man, realizing that your fellow man has a divine spark of the Almighty in them, and we're all God's children. It's very important, very powerful thing with that. And again, well, Jim, there's evil people in the world. There's evil people in the world. We understand that. So what do we do? Do we stop fighting evil? Do we stop? Do we promote good? Okay, maybe we don't fight so much, but maybe let's promote good things out there. So we're going to go into some news here. And hold on here. Well, Jim, what do you do? Well, you know, we had, I don't want to do so much post-production. So yesterday we had, I don't keep a clean desktop here, right? So when I do a share screen, sometimes you get some stuff that we shouldn't be, nothing bad, but you know. Anyway, okay, here we go. Share this. Okay, NIH. To fund, and if we recall, I was on Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett, rest in peace, Ian, when this whole thing at East Palestine came out. So NIH to fund long-term health studies for East Palestine after train disaster. Today, at the year, and this is from today, from Health and Human Services, NIH to fund long-term health studies for East Palestine after the train disaster. Today, at the urging of Vice President J.D. Vance and the leadership of U.S. Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the National Institutes of Health launched a five-year, $10 million research initiative to assess and address the long-term health outcomes stemming from the 2023 train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. Vice President Vance, thank you for your persistence on this issue, Secretary Kennedy said. You helped drive the first large-scale coordinated multi-year federal study dedicated to long-term health effects of the East Palestine, Ohio disaster. The people of East Palestine have a right to clear science-backed answers about the impact on health. As a senator, it was incredibly frustrating watching the Biden administration refuse to examine the potentially dangerous health impacts on the people of East Palestine following the train derailment, Vice President Vance said. I'm proud that we finally have a new president that takes the concerns of everyday working class people seriously. This historic research initiative will finally result in answers that this community deserves. I'm grateful for the work of Secretary Kennedy and Director Bhattacharya on these efforts. On February 3rd, 2023, a Norfolk Southern freight train derailment involving 38 cars carrying hazardous chemicals, including vinyl chloride, butyl acrylate, ethylene glycol, and benzene residue, resulted in prolonged fires and control burns in East Palestine. Following the derailment, several rail cars burned for more than 2 days, and emergency responders conducted control burns, which raised concerns about the airborne release of hydrogen chloride and phosgene. Community members experienced and reported a range of initial health symptoms, including headaches as well as respiratory, skin, and eye irritations, prompting concern about broad long-term impacts on maternal and child health, as well as psychological, immunological, respiratory, and cardiovascular effects. NIH is working to ensure that the people of East Palestine and the surrounding communities are listened to, cared for, and get the answers they deserve, NIH Director Jay Bhattacharya said. This multidisciplinary research program will focus on public health tracking and surveillance of the community's health conditions to support healthcare decisions and prevent preventative measures. The multidisciplinary community focus series will, and it has a whole bunch of stories here. And I think, you know, I'm going to go and jump ahead to one story here from Vox. And they have all this stuff, right? Put America first and everything, a lot of praising here and posturing and everything else. Good thing. I mean, we're out there. Again, NIH and a lot of these other organizations have lost a lot of credibility for a whole host of reasons. Well, Jim, what do you mean their loss of a lot of credibility? They lost a lot of credibility. So we're going to go to a article. I got to get this off here because this is I got to go back to me here because this is not a government website we're talking about here. So this came across my desk today, and this is in a related story here with this. And of course, the website goes dark. So this is all of Vox.com. Article came out yesterday by Noam Hassenfeld. All right. This veteran health official watched Americans lose trust in science. How do we get it back? All right. So, hold on. Again, live radio, everybody. Authenticity. Francis Collins led the NIH for a decade before its dismantling. He is searching for answers. Francis Collins has overseen some of the most revolutionary science of the past few decades. He led the Human Genome Project, which sequenced the entire human genome in 2023. Yeah, so this guy is well-qualified, well-experienced. But nothing in his years leading to biomedical research for the U.S. government could have prepared him for the disruption at NIH and National Institutes for Health, NIH, over the past few months. Over 1,000 employees at the NIH were suddenly fired at the beginning of April. Those fire rings are still being challenged in the courts, but as for now, the employees remain out of work. Trump administration officials have barred researchers from studying certain topics like vaccine hesitancy or the health effects of wildfires. Quote, Collins, this is a quote from Collins. I had experienced transition before, and those are bumpy sometimes, but I didn't expect science to be under this kind of full-bore attack. Again, why am I sharing this? Because we as safety people were tasked often with enforcing all of these COVID guidelines. We lost, I don't care what anybody says, we lost a lot of freaking credibility because we went under this stuff. And it was all, and we had to enforce a lot of this stuff. Companies, I'm the vice president. I'm the president. I'm so-and-so. I can't get the workforce pissed off at me. But I tell you what, that low-paid health and safety professional, well, what do I care? Often they're a consultant. I'll bring him in as a consultant. Let him piss everybody off, then we can be blaming him for time and eternity. Yeah, that's actually what happened. I've seen that. That's actually what happened, right? Collins, who had stepped down as NIH director in 2020 and had taken over a lab studying diabetes, soon felt he could no longer do his job as a scientist should. He started to worry he might be pushed out, so I pulled my folks together in a conference room. They didn't know what it was, and basically he said, I'm out of here, right? And just 4 years ago, Collins was president of Trump's President Donald Trump's NIH director. Now in Trump's second term, he's resigning under pressure. How do we get from a world where the NIH was universally recognized as a jewel of scientific research to a world where the government is essentially tearing it down from the inside? So this is a question from the author. I'm constantly hearing that Americans have lost trust in science. Is that fair to say? I think it's totally fair. You can look at the surveys about trust. Americans have lost trust in almost every institution. But I think it was more than that. I think COVID did a lot of harm to people's trust in science because, first of all, it was a huge, disastrous experience for the world. There were days where thousands of Americans were dying. As one of those people who was communicating with the public about what we knew about the virus, what we might do to protect themselves, we were doing the best we could with the information we had, but the information was incomplete, so we often had to change recommendations over time because we learned more about the virus and about the pandemic, and so people began to wonder, do these guys know what they're talking about? Sound familiar if you're in the safety industry? I think so. So suddenly this has become such a target for an attack, whether science is something that's good for a country or not. Your most recent book, The Road to Wisdom, is all about trust. If you were telling the story of the loss of trust and everything going on in the science agencies today, how far back would you talk? Would you start? It depends on the particular demographic you're talking about. I'm a person of faith, and certainly people of faith have tended to be among the most skeptical of science, and that goes back 150 years or more. This guy is, like, really intelligent. I hope that he's being quoted accurately, because I like this guy. He's, you know, deep diver, like, you know, he's good. The sense that maybe science is trying to do damage to our Christian faith, that, and I can tell you that, yeah, there were instances in college where there were a couple of professors that actually did do that, right? They were certainly there well before COVID, but what group was most resistant to accepting the vaccines was a white evangelical Christian. I'm a white evangelical Christian, so those are my people, but it broke my heart to see how that happened. And I think COVID did something, took what had been a tendency for science to be political and turned into a really big deal. If you were a Democrat, you're much more likely to get vaccinated than if you were a Republican. Does that make sense? Not in the slightest, but that's how it was. When it's becoming clear that more than 50 million Americans aren't getting the vaccine, one of the most remarkable scientific achievements in human history, I would debate that, but I digress. Did that tell you anything about pseudoscience and how it works? It certainly woke me up to the fact that we were apparently had not done a very good job in explaining to people that when science is tackling some really hard problems and occasionally gets the wrong answer, it's going to get self-corrected because science is about truth. Science is not just a bunch of people who are coming up with answers that they like. These are the answers that aren't going to be sustainable unless they're actually true. And maybe that here is also where I began to realize there's another problem that society has that I was unaware of in terms of its severity, the importance of truth. I would call it genuineness, right? The fact that there is such a thing as objective truth. Not everybody shared that. That might be true for you, but it's not true for me, I would hear people say about things that were established facts. And that's the road to destruction of a society if it becomes widespread. Unfortunately, it seems to be going that way. It seems you believe that all you had to do was develop the vaccine, get to the thing that worked, and then people would take it. Then there's this whole other piece of convincing people that you and the scientific community at large didn't do. Yeah, and this is Collins Rivers Funny. Yeah, I was naive about the science communication and how it works. And I was, without knowing to call it this, an adherent to the knowledge deficit model. What is that? That means that if you're trying to communicate science to get somebody to make a decision, it's because they're missing knowledge. Hey, I grew up in this. Safety people grew up, this is perfect, right? Probably the most important thing in here, the knowledge deficit model. That means that if you're trying to communicate science to get somebody to make a decision, it's because they're missing knowledge, and you're going to provide that. You're going to fill their deficit, and then everything will be fine. You just tell them, here's the fact, and now they believe the fact, the author responds. Yes, I am an expert. Here's the fact. And they'll make the right decision. But no, it doesn't work that way, especially when there's already skepticism and distrust. You are seen as an elitist who maybe has an axe to grind or something you're trying to put over on them. And you may not even do more, and you may even do more harm than good by going after someone's misunderstandings head on. They're just going to dig their heels in more thoroughly. I guess what I have learned is we need to do a lot more listening. Again, Jay Allen, right there. Do more listening, right? And Jay would also probably say, ask better questions. And really, right? And it goes on, and really understand where people are coming from. And also be prepared to tell stories instead of going down the road. Wow, he must have gotten with Jay Allen, because this is exactly what Jay Allen has said in his books. Here and on the Rated R Safety Show and the podcast here on the Great Safety FM Network. Right? So be prepared to tell the stories, right? That's why at the beginning of my career, nobody wanted me to tell stories. One, I wasn't a very good storyteller. I get that, but at times. But number one. But number two is the stories are more effective than anything that you could give. Right? They'll remember the stories. For scientists, what I've learned, let me start over. I guess what I've learned is we need to do a lot more listening and really understand where people are coming from. And also be prepared to tell stories instead of going down the road with statistics. But that's challenging. For a scientist, that sounds like an anecdote, and I would never get away with that in a seminar room. But this is not the seminar room, people. We need to actually find better ways to help people understand what we do. That's what this is, right? You were in charge of the NIH during COVID. You were often the one communicating to the public. Are there things that you would do differently? I wish every time myself or anybody who was putting forward a public health message was started out saying, look, this is an evolving situation. We still don't know answers to a lot of these things we need to know about the pandemic. So what I'm going to tell you today is the data we've got, but we might have to change that later when we get more info. We almost never said that. The other thing is our one-size-fits-all approach just didn't feel like it made any sense to the public. People in rural communities who are far away from the carnage that was happening in New York City or Washington, D.C. as the virus was running wild were left wondering, why do I have to close my business? I haven't even seen cases here yet. I think we lost a lot of people in states that didn't necessarily have heavy academic research centers who couldn't quite imagine how they should believe us because we didn't seem to like we understood what life was like on a small farm in Nebraska. During COVID, my number one goal was to save lives. I'm a physician. I took the Hippocratic Oath. I assumed there were other people worrying about the economic effects of this and the effects on children's learning when they were kept out of school. It didn't feel like I was like that was my thing. My thing was to try to keep people from dying. But it became clear to me that that may have been something I was a little bit too wearing blinders about. Maybe those other factors about economic harms and harms to children's learning should have been a bit more at the front and center of the conversation I was part of. This is phenomenal. I'm going to do a shout out to this guy. This is great, I mean, so far. So this is the author again. So I understand looking back on it and saying, okay, it would have been more accurate to communicate the level of uncertainty to say to people, this is evolving, we don't know, you don't think that would have led to a different outcome. I don't know. I wish we could do the experiment, and maybe we could figure out a way to do it some controlled space. But I would say 20% of the problem was the less than perfect communication in the science, and 80% of it was a deluge of misinformation and disinformation, which, we've covered extensively during the whole situation. That contaminated the conversation to the point where people stopped listening to the actual facts. There didn't seem to be any penalty for stating something that's absolutely false, though I haven't heard anyone apologize for that. Back to the author. When I think about your willingness to have difficult conversations and accept responsibility for mistakes, it seems like this is something that most people are not doing. I've heard you mention maybe we could have something like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or a pandemic amnesty on a larger level, where people could really be open about their mistakes. Do you think that could have any effect? Yeah, and the response. You know, I proposed the idea of amnesty at an event, and the audience blew up. They were not there. People are too angry. On both sides? On both sides. They're feeling too hurt. Too much harm has been done to them. So amnesty, I don't care. Think we're there. Truth and reconciliation, people are okay with that because they can imagine that other people are going to have to ask for forgiveness for what they did. Again, this does not only apply to this situation. It applies in other contexts. Think about the church abuse scandals. I'm sure everybody would be like, you know, would be okay, that maybe not as bad, you can move on to healing if, right, you can move on to healing if the churches would say, look, this is what we did wrong, and can you please forgive us? That's all that what happened, because that's what the church requires of you. We're not only talking Catholic Church and Orthodox and Episcopal. We're talking, that's all of them. They require some type of confession, forgiveness, absolution. Right? I think, right, if we could get to that point, I think we might go somewhere, maybe be able to start moving forward on here. But right now, we're so dug in. I hope that this truth and reconciliation option is out there right now, but it doesn't quite feel like people are ready to go there. Right, here it is. Another question. It seems to me that we need more is more people embracing uncertainty, more people talking about their mistakes, whether it's people with their friends who they disagree with or whether it's the highest scientists in our scientific agencies. How do we get there? Response, we are a long way from there. When you're in the circumstance where there seems to be a real pitch battle between the various tribes, it makes it hard for anyone to say, I might be wrong. The fact that I've been willing to say that has resulted in a lot of attacks, even from people who I thought were my friends. They say, oh no, you can't show weakness like that. Well, yeah, we really do need to do that. We need to do it. It's not just to expect for a few people who are then going to get whacked for it. Again, blame fixes nothing. It's hard right now. You don't see a lot of that in our country. So, back to the author. If I were a young scientist and I wasn't sure whether I should stay in the field, what would you say to me? I'd say you're at a really paradoxical time because this is the most incredibly exciting moment for biomedical research. So many things are becoming possible that I would not have dreamed would have happened in my lifetime. We're on this exponential curve of gathering insights. So if that's your dream to be part of, don't give it up. Now the paradox is right at the moment. There's a lot of negative things happening in the United States that seem to be threats, but that case here is so compelling, I don't believe that those facts can be suppressed for very long. You can already look at the polls in which the American public says, I don't think they should be harming medical research. That's right there. 77% of Americans raised that point in one poll. There are people on both sides of the aisle. There's some momentum here. So this was at Vox.com in the science section. Article was by Noam Hassenfeld, and he was interviewing Francis Collins, who was the former head of the NIH. I'm going to give kudos to you, if we're even allowed to say that anymore. I'm going to compliment you on a very well-written article, and I think I'm going to add one thing here. What you needed was somebody out there communicating with people who was a little bit more effective? Or how could we have been more effective? It all comes down to human and organizational performance, folks. What is safety? What is safety? Is safety the absence of accidents, illness, in this case, illnesses, 000, that damn 000 sign, right? Zero accidents, zero illnesses, zero injuries, zero releases, zero problems. But we all know that those are zero problems reported, right? Not that they don't happen with that, usually, with most organizations. Versus what I use and what everyone here on the network uses, what the modern definition is, capacity and resilience, right? What you're able to do and what you're able to adapt, right? Your capacity. So you add more guards, you add more capacity to the situation, you add more resilience, people able to adapt, adaptation goes in there. And if we have those things, then we have safety. So that means that you can have one thing and now, guess what? You have one thing. Well, okay, the controls didn't work. How could we change that? How could we help make things safer? And that, right? And I think that needs to be communicated. Wouldn't it have been like, look, we're not sure how to protect yourself with this. We have ever-changing information, but we do know this. We're going to add capacity to our system. Right? That's what we're recommending. We're in the masks. Right now, it turns out that might not have really impacted things, right? And the COVID after action report released in December by Congress, right? But we have that. We have social distancing, right? We're going to add that control or that safeguard in there. Washing your hands, right? Quarantining or segregating people. And then it goes on and with all the other things there. So we're adding controls to this. That doesn't mean we're not going to have any COVID. But as we get more information, we're going to do this. We're going to try to be as transparent as we can here with you. Asking you is a very difficult time. We need to be able to do this. Again, we're going to be able to work with you and with things. Just bear with us. Wouldn't that have been nice? Because what does this do? Your response to leadership matters. Another HOP principle. Your response matters to bad news, to information, to people, and that leadership matters. And that is a perfect thing with this. And if you read Jay Allen's new books, right, let's get them up here on Amazon here. So I don't foul this up. Right? The trilogy here. Right? Safety, in my opinion, consciousness, construct, and reality of risk. Signal transmission. Right? Trilogy book one. Safety, in my opinion. All right? You go into that. And, right, that's book one. Book two. Safety, in my opinion. Consciousness, construct. Right? Safety mutation, information misdirection, safety transmission, the collapse of the construct. I'm reading that right now. He mentions how human and organizational performance, right, Jay Allen does, is a broad-based application. And this is one instance, this is Vox, this article in Vox. And, that's what I got for tonight. Let's go. We're at 44 minutes almost. That's the hour. We're going to go to another commercial break here. And we have more stuff coming on. I've been working on new commercials and stuff. So you're in for a treat come tomorrow or next week.
In an unpredictable world, one voice rises above the chaos. Meet Jim Pozo, a seasoned safety expert who's navigated through some of the most dangerous scenarios, from anthrax, explosive cleanups, disasters, and numerous environmental cleanups, and lived to tell the tale. Now he's bringing his wealth of knowledge, insights, and experiences to you through Safety Wars. From workplace hazards to the hidden dangers in your own home, Jim covers it all with his engaging storytelling. Safety Wars isn't just a podcast. It's your guide to a safer world. Join Jim Pozzo and become part of the Safety Wars revolution. Available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and wherever you get your podcasts and videos. Safety Wars. Your safety is our mission.
Is your safety training old, stale, and hackneyed? Is your safety trainer still preaching a warped version of behavior-based safety? How about safety training that actually addresses your hazards in your workplaces and is not standardized baloney from 25 years ago? Contact the Safety Wars team at safetywars.com or call Jim Pozzle at 845-269-5772. Remember, if you're receiving this message, you are the solution to unsafe workplaces.
From the front lines of the safety war, it's Safety Wars, with your host, Jim Pozzle on Safety FM. Get ready to face the harsh reality.
So here we have some more stuff. This is from the HHS.gov website here. Robert RFK Jr., hey, HHS moves to restore public trust in vaccines. And this is from June 9th. Vaccines have become a divisive issue in American politics, but there is one thing all parties can agree on. The U.S. faces a crisis of public trust, whether toward health agencies, pharmaceutical companies, or vaccines themselves. Public confidence is waning. Some would try to explain this away by blaming misinformation or anti-science attitudes. To do so, however, ignores the history of conflicts of interest, persecution of dissidents, a lack of curiosity, and skewed science. Again, lack of curiosity, huh? Learning teams, they got to have curiosity. And skewed science that has plagued the vaccine regulatory apparatus for decades. That is why, under my direction, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is putting the restoration of public trust above any pro- or anti-vaccine agenda. Public must know what that unbiased science guides the recommendations, right? Let me try it again. The public must know that unbiased science guides the recommendations from our health agencies. This will ensure the American people receive their safest vaccines possible. Today, we are taking a bold step in restoring public trust by totally reconstituting the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, ACIP. We are retiring the 17 current members of the committee, some of whom were last-minute appointees of the Biden administration. Without removing the current members, the current Trump administration would not have been able to appoint a majority of new members until 2028. And so in 2000, the House issued the results of an investigation of ACIP and another vaccine advisory committee under the U.S. FDA, the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee. It found that enforcement of its conflict of interest rules was weak. I mean, they're going back 25 years for this. Committee members regularly participated in deliberations and advocated products in which they had a financial stake. The CDC issued conflict of interest waivers to every committee member. 4 out of the 8 ACIP members who voted in 1997 on guidelines for the RotaShield vaccine subsequently withdrawn because of severe adverse events, had financial ties to pharmaceutical companies developing other rotavirus vaccines. In 2009, HHS Inspector General report echoed these findings. Few committee members were in full conflict of interest. Few committee members completed full conflict of interest forms. 97% of them had omissions. The CDC took no further action to remedy the omissions. These conflicts of interest persist. Most ACIP's members have received substantial funding from pharmaceutical companies, including those marketing vaccines. The problem isn't necessarily that ACIP members are corrupt. Most likely aim to serve the public interest as they understand it. The problem is their immersion in a system of industry-aligned incentives and paradigms that enforce a narrow pro-industry orthodoxy. Again, what were we talking about? At the beginning of the show with Juneteenth. Incentives. What's the incentive here? With this perverse sometimes. I don't know if these people, what their incentives are. I don't know. I don't know if they did anything wrong. But you had the appearance of something bad here, right? The new members won't directly work the vaccine industry. They will exercise independent judgment, refuse to serve as a rubber stamp, and foster a culture of critical inquiry. Unafraid to ask hard questions. A clean sweep is needed to reestablish public confidence in vaccine science. In the 1960s, the world sought guidance from America's health regulators, who had a reputation for integrity, scientific impartiality, and zealous defense of patient welfare. Public trust has since collapsed, but we will earn it back. Okay. All right. Here we have that. We talked about that. And I forgot to take off share screen. Aye. And here we have this. We're going to share this one again. This is from Health and Human Services. Just happened to be on their website today, you know. U.S. The HHS announces Paul M. Standard as the Director of Office for Civil Rights. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights announces the appointment of Paula M. Standard as Director of Office for Civil Rights. In this role, Director Standard is the department's chief officer and advisor to Senator Secretary RFK Jr. Concerning the implementation, compliance, and enforcement of federal health information privacy, security, and breach notification rules under the Health Insurance Portable Accountability Act, a.k.a. HIPAA, as well as federal civil rights, conscience, and religious freedom laws, and HHS's jurisdiction. I am proud to welcome Paula back to the HHS, said Secretary Kennedy. She's a proven public servant who delivered results during her time at HHS, both under President Trump and President Bush. Paula brings deep institutional knowledge, relentless focus, and unwavering commitment to civil rights. Under her leadership, the Office of Civil Rights will drive toward forward President Trump's bold civil rights agenda with clarity, energy, and purpose. Most recently, Director Standard served as Chief Legal Counsel of the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services, where she led the Office of Legal Affairs. In this capacity, she advised and represented the state agency and its components on a wide range of significant legal issues pertaining to the laws in the agency, the laws in the agency is responsible for implementing and the programs it operates. Director Standard's previous federal service includes her role as a senior counselor and advisor to former HHS Secretary Tom Price and Secretary Alex Azar during the first Trump administration, serving as acting general counsel and deputy general counsel during the George W. Bush administration. And it goes on and on and on. And she says, I am excited and honored to lead the Office for Civil Rights at HHS under the leadership of President Trump and Secretary Kennedy. I look forward to advancing the significant and highly visible priorities of OCR and protecting the human civil rights of Americans who participate in the programs or organizations that HHS operates and funds. She is a graduate of Amherst College and Stanford Law School. Outside work, Paul enjoys walking, hiking, reading, knitting, and crocheting. So OCR is uniquely charged with the enforcing HIPAA privacy, security, and breach notification rules, federal civil rights laws, and conscience and religious freedom laws. OCR promotes and enforces laws that protect our nation's security by advancing health information privacy and regulating our nation's healthcare systems, cybersecurity. Additionally, OCR administers and enforces laws that prohibit discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin, sex, age, disability, and religion, and some of the most critical programs across the nation. Those related to health and social security services, OCR accomplishes its mission through enforcement, rulemaking, guidance, technical assistance, training, education, and outreach. Right? And it goes on and on and on. So, we're there. We're at 54 minutes after the hour. So, what do you guys think about the program tonight? A little bit different here, right, with this. Some of the other things that are out there in the safety news, in the last couple of days. Bombshell report reveals cause of Dominican Republic roof collapses from the New York Post that killed 236. Complete disregard for building and safety laws. The owners of the doomed Jet Set nightclub in the Dominican Republic, where 236 people were buried alive earlier this year, ignored obvious warning signs of building safety laws leading to the catastrophic collapse, Bombshell new government report reveals. Sibling club owners Antonio and Maribel Espilat, who were arrested last week, overloaded the building's roof, made structural changes without permits, refused to call off the ill-fated April 8th bash despite obvious signs of danger hours earlier. The defendant, from the public ministry, the defendant was aware of a falling debris incident hours before the collapse and in response to requests to suspend the activity, refused to do so, citing the absence of the defendant, Lopez, and the impossibility of stopping the party, prioritizing economic gain over the safety and lives of people. The nightclub, originally a movie theater, underwent a change of use that involved an inadequate structural adaptation. A key column in the structure was subsequently removed, significantly affecting the roof's stability, without any professional assessment or permit to support the modification, demonstrating high-risk behavior. Again, what does this tell you? You're a safety professional. You make a recommendation. Person tells you, no, we're not going to do it. Okay, get it in writing, but I don't think, no, remember, the Hannah Gutierrez Reed. She got it in writing from her supervisor not to worry about safety issues. I don't worry about it. No, we're supposed to have meetings and stuff, right? I don't worry about it. You don't need to do it. Worry about the props, not the safety, not the armory duties. Right? That's the Alec Baldwin Rust case. Again, this was in the Dominican Republic. Laws are different. In the United States, in some areas, you know, you might get prosecuted over this, like New York State, New Mexico being two of the places. So that's all I got for tonight. We're going to go into our outro, and I hope to see you this tomorrow. If not, have a great weekend. I'll see you back here on Monday. Maybe I'll get on over the weekend. I don't know. We'll see. I always say that, and it just, we get backed up with stuff. For Safety Wars, this is Jim Pozel.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
Won't take you down. Stay protected, keep your crown.